Welcome to the latest edition of the Sight Screen Cricket Journal podcast. I'm your host, Tove Qureshi, and today we'll be covering the New Zealand-Bangladesh series. I'm really happy to introduce our guest today. She's joining us all the way over from New Zealand, all the way down from New Zealand, I guess. She is an international broadcaster, cricket journalist. She has expert opinions, not only on New Zealand cricket, but also Pakistan cricket and indeed English cricket. She is Tasneem Samar Khan. Welcome, Tasneem.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you on. I know this has been in the planning for a little while, so it's fine.
A long time coming.
Absolutely, yeah. So time zones permitting, it's been great to pin down the time for both of us. So welcome. Let's get straight into it then. Wanted to obviously cover the New Zealand-Bangladesh white ball series that's recently concluded. Obviously a resoundingly successful series for New Zealand. On the other hand, not so good for Bangladesh, basically beaten in every single game and in some of those games quite comprehensively. So I guess worth recapping quickly some of those margins of victory, or margins of loss actually, for Bangladesh. So in the first ODI, New Zealand won by 8 wickets. In the second ODI in Christchurch, which was actually when Bangladesh were at their most competitive and kind of at one stage could have potentially won that game, but they ended up losing by 5 wickets. And then in that last ODI at Wellington, New Zealand won by a whopping 164 runs. Didn't change much in terms of the T20 series. First T20, New Zealand won by 66 runs. The second one, they won on DLS by 28 runs. But we will hopefully touch on that a bit later because there was a bit of confusion around that DLS score. But New Zealand ending up winning that one quite comfortably. And then in that last game, I think that's when the wheels really totally came off for Bangladesh. It was a game reduced to 10 overs a side in Auckland because of rain. Bangladesh ended up being bowled out inside 10 overs, losing that game by 65 runs. So on the face of it, quite a comprehensive defeat for Bangladesh all ends up. But Tasneem, what was your take on the series?
If you look at the score lines, it very much looks very one-sided. And throughout many of the matches, it's true that New Zealand were very comfortable, but I think there were absolutely moments, particularly in that second game in the ODI series, where things could have looked a little bit different. It's a matter, and I think this is really where the difference between sides like New Zealand, which are very well-established sides with a lot of stability, sides with excellent structures, and this is domestic cricketing structures from age group to professional cricket, I think that's where you can really see the difference between certain teams on the global sphere. In a series like this, where New Zealand absolutely gave Bangladesh more than a couple of opportunities, there were chances to take the match and take it in a different with a different momentum. Bangladesh, I think, in my assessment, they repeatedly failed to do so. And I think that's very frustrating to watch as a fan, because sometimes things just don't go your way. And that's tough to watch. And sometimes you're just very much outclassed, outmatched. That's also tough to watch. But when you're watching a situation where you know that players and that team, that side in general, had chances and just failed to capitalize on them, exerting pressure, I think really that is exactly what we're watching, a slight gulf of in terms of world cricket, international cricket at the moment. It's those teams that are so professionalized that they take every opportunity, that they don't drop sitters. It just doesn't happen, and it doesn't happen, you know, several overs in a row. So I think that is really, for me, the key difference. Look, if we're going to be very honest, New Zealand is an exceptionally strong team at home. I've been living here for 2 seasons now. We probably shouldn't measure time in cricket seasons, but I just did. I've lived here for 2 seasons now, and I watched England tour here and I watched India tour here. And these are 2 sides that are world-leading sides, and Australia as well. So 3 world-leading sides. And I watched nobody win a comprehensive series against New Zealand. India had some really good T20 matches against New Zealand. That's really the one exception. But otherwise, pretty much everybody seems to leave these shores feeling like a lesser cricketing side. We watched it the entire summer in Bangladesh. We're just the last victims of the Black Caps' excellent summer. So I think a lot of it comes down to professionalism. A lot of it comes down to excellent structures. But some of it is just that the Black Caps are on an absolutely beautiful hot streak. So just in terms of New Zealand's perspective, I think it's going to be really fascinating getting to see them touring again and seeing what they can do on other people's shores.
Indeed, yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're coming over here to England, aren't they, to play a test series against England, and of course they've got the World Test Championship against India, which will be a fascinating game as well. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right. There seems to be a bit of a juggernaut in terms of the Black Caps at the moment, just steamrolling all of the opposition that they find in front of them. Certainly, it's been a fantastically successful home summer. Like you say, they've won all their series resoundingly. So yeah, fantastic kind of effort from them. I guess from a Bangladesh perspective, yeah, they were always going to be up against it. They've never won a single game actually in New Zealand previously. So, they were always going to be up against it. Having said that, for me personally, I feel they excuse me, it pains me clearly to talk about it still. I felt that they underperformed essentially, even though, I wasn't necessarily expecting them to kind of win the series, or indeed win a game, but I think those margins of victory really were quite comprehensive, and I think they underperformed. And as you say, I think they underperformed at key stages and at sort of key moments in the game. There seemed to me to be a lack of maybe game sense, for want of a better phrase. So at key moments, at key phases of the game where you've got to be 110% switched on to what's happening and what's happening around you, I felt that they kind of failed during those moments. And as you've kind of alluded to, that game at Christchurch, there was certainly a chance there to kind of put pressure on the chase in terms of that total that New Zealand were chasing. But yeah, as you say, they dropped a couple of absolute dolly catches. I did speak about this to Roshan, who I know you know very well, in the last podcast. We dissected that game in quite a bit of detail, so I don't really want to dwell too much on that. But so far to say that, yeah, it really was well, the fielding was certainly sort of sub-international standard, which didn't kind of contribute at all to their cause. But just flipping things on their head a little bit, and trying to kind of glean some positives from the Bangladesh point of view. For me, I thought there were some encouraging signs, I guess, from some of the younger members in the team. Although it's difficult to actually say that there was any outstanding individual performances. I don't think there were. And I actually gave some player ratings out of 10, and I don't think I scored anyone above 4 or 4.5 actually. So that kind of says its own story. Maybe I'm being completely harsh, maybe. But yeah, just from your point of view, Tasneem, were you able to kind of glean any sort of positives from any of the Bangladesh performances?
Yes. And you know what's fascinating about this is that so all the West Indians I spoke to this summer, all the Caribbean analysts, all the Pakistanis, and now similarly Bangladesh fans as well, everybody has that opinion. Everybody has walked away from whatever has happened in New Zealand this summer and said, just no positives. It hurts so much. Nobody was above a 4 out of 10. And I think there's actually a story there about what New Zealand does to touring teams. I think everybody feels like they underperformed. I think everybody comes here a little bit on the back foot, and I think that's actually a massive problem. There's such a mental block for a lot of batsmen traveling. Look, with the West Indies, I think everybody thought, well, Darren Bravo, that'll go well. he wasn't able to perform with Pakistan. Obviously, a lot of hopes were pinned on Babar Azam, who ended up being injured for the series. And that's one of the issues. If you're touring a very complete nation that is already slightly difficult to play in terms of, I think Bangladesh cricketers are just as uncomfortable with shorter pitch bowling as Pakistanis are. So you're already a little bit on the back foot because of the pitch conditions that you're not comfortable with. You're already on the back foot because it's a really complete team. And then pinning your hopes on individuals. So with this tour in hand, the individual that I had pinned my hopes on from a Bangladeshi standpoint was Tamim Iqbal. And fantastic player. And I do want to touch on him because I think that racking up your best score in New Zealand isn't something that should fail to get mentioned. It's not an easy place to bat on. You bat long, you bat slow, and you're going to be able to do something with it, as we saw Tom Latham do in the match where Bangladesh failed to exert the pressure that they needed. So we have this over-reliance on individual performers because we don't necessarily have very strong, complete touring squads coming here. So that's one initial problem, over-reliance. And then the psychological aspect. When you're coming to a place where you know that you've got a very complete bowling lineup to compete with, where you've got copious amounts of batsmen to the extent that if Kane Williamson is injured, then you're still not really that worried about it. And you are picking from bench strength, which just seems to be getting better and better. So I think that we need to take all of these things into consideration where we remember that all of these guys are touring. They're touring in COVID times and they're touring a very notoriously difficult place to tour. So I think praise where it is due. I would like to praise Bangladesh for keeping their composure for the entirety of the tour, but I do think we saw that final T20 match where everything just like ripped apart at the seams. So it was a shame that they couldn't hold on a game longer, because I do think that kind of tour is an exercise in mental fortitude. It is how to lose without feeling like you've been beaten down, right? And part of that is mental as much as the scoreline. I don't think Bangladesh achieved that, sadly. So that's probably the criticism that I would have. I think, and Roshan and I talked a little bit about this, I think that some of that South Asian culture has a lot to do with that mentality of how we break down how the sides did and what needs to happen as a result of that. We are maybe not as structured in our thinking, at least in the cricketing sense, where we go back to the drawing board and think about the basics. For instance, I think both Bangladesh and Pakistan had the exact same problem in touring New Zealand, which is that their domestic structures aren't strong enough to support, and the West Indies as well, it was the exact same issue. Their domestic structures aren't strong enough. So when you do have people going away on paternity leave or being injured or missing a flight for some reason and then being put on a COVID list and then saying, no, don't worry, I don't have COVID, I just missed my flight. The various things that we've seen this summer, when that's the situation that you're working with, I think you are just structurally ill-prepared. On to the positives, though. I do think that the meme, it's interesting because obviously he's made a decision in the midst of this series. And I think that decision is something worth talking about as well. But just in terms of an individual performance, I think the meme did probably what we are all accustomed to seeing him do, which is showing his ridiculous promise that makes him one of the most enjoyable batsmen in the world to watch, and then having a bunch of matches where he fails to deliver on said promise. And I think that's a little bit of a repeated pattern. So I don't think that he needs to be beaten down for doing exactly what we know his consistency is like. But I do think that that was a pretty remarkable score, getting your top score in New Zealand, not too bad. In terms of the other players, I don't think anybody stood up or stood out. Debutants, younger players, however, I saw a fire and an energy and a push to keep bowling, a push to keep going in difficult circumstances that I think is the best part of the series that we just saw. Because it's about the future. It's about looking forward. It's the same reason that I enjoy watching the under-19s. And I think Bangladesh is a decent team at the under-19s level. Pakistan's a decent team at the under-19s level as well. And then at some stage in the international sphere, there starts to be a disconnect. I strongly suspect that culture has a lot to do with that, whether that's the culture of a country or just in terms of management cultures, coaching cultures, that kind of thing. So I think that there's a couple of positives, which is the kids look fired up and competitive. the warning signs are we going to do the exact same thing with these kids that we've done for the last 10, 15 plus years?
Yeah, no, I take a lot of those points on board. Yeah, certainly. I think in terms of the younger performers that you kind of mentioned there, yeah, in terms of the bowling, I felt that guys like Shorefall really kind of did quite well. So I felt he was absolutely thrown in at the deep end in that first, you know, making your international debut in a T20 game against New Zealand, who, are, like you say, are absolutely on fire. He got smashed to all parts. I think it was none for 50 were his figures off his four overs in that first game. But then actually came back in those last two games and actually bowled very commendably. You know, he didn't set the world on fire, but, you know, he actually came back and kind of showed a little bit about, you know, a little bit of what he's about and what he's capable of doing. So I thought that was good. The other kind of plus, I guess, was Tuskin Ahmed and his kind of resurgence or reemergence from injury. Again, he didn't take like a bucket full of wickets. Again, no one did. I don't think, New Zealand weren't bowled out at any time throughout the whole series, but he still sort of showed good kind of speed. Actually, he was touching 140 plus quite regularly, KPH quite regularly, which is a good sign for him, and just showing generally that he's kind of overcome his kind of fitness worries. So I think, yeah, there were a couple of positive signs. But yeah, I mean, you've kind of touched on a whole host of issues to unpick, which will probably take us hours to cover. So I'm not even going to try to. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right in terms of mental strength and domestic structure. I think all of those things have a part to play. I mean, just touching on domestic cricket in Bangladesh, it's virtually been on hiatus for sort of coming up to a year and a half, almost 2 years. They did recently play two rounds of their first class competition, but again, that's been postponed because of a spike in COVID coronavirus cases in Bangladesh. So yeah, there really is a big kind of grey area and question mark around how appropriate or how fit for purpose the domestic structure and the domestic game is in Bangladesh, for sure, which certainly doesn't help when they tour abroad. But moving on to New Zealand then, we have spoken about it already, but just interested to sort of find your views on why they have been so successful of late. I mean, for me particularly, obviously I've kind of followed them since, maybe not followed them as closely as I should have since the 2019 World Cup. Obviously, we all watched that World Cup final. And, you know, throughout that tournament, you know, we all recognise what a good white ball team New Zealand are. But they actually seem to have grown over the last couple of years into an even better team and an even better squad. And for me, watching players who I hadn't seen before, such as Finn Allen and Devon Conway, was a real revelation. I mean, some of the ball striking of those two guys was quite phenomenal throughout the series. And indeed, Tom Latham as skippering that ODI team, and in Kane Williamson's absence, and doing brilliantly as well. Are there any kind of things that you can point towards for New Zealand being so successful?
Yeah, and it's really boring and unsexy an answer. It's such a boring answer. Whereas I'll give the example of Pakistan, whereas Pakistan considers cricketing structures top to bottom, New Zealand does it the other way around. Their domestic structures are strong. Look, it's a very small country. There is a very small talent pool compared to Bangladesh and Pakistan, which are countries of 200 million. But there is absolutely something very specific that they do with said talent pool, which is support it. That support is holistic. It's on the field. It's off the field. I have been in situations where domestically I'm watching a guy do pretty mediocre, and you just don't hear negative assertions about mediocre players. Like, whereas, look, I did something with Pakistan the other day about the Pakistan South Africa series, and I heard criticisms about Fakhar Zaman after he scored almost 200 and averaged 100 a game in an ODI series. And this is just a cultural context, right? But I will see mediocre players that don't have a tenth of that talent not get treated like that. They get treated well. And funnily enough, when people get treated well, when people get supported, then they do well. They flourish, they blossom, they become better versions of themselves. They become the complete player that they could have been, as opposed to knocking down talent at such early stages that they never actually flourish into the talent they should have been. So it's really boring an answer, but I honestly think that the positive vibes culture that is thought about in cricket. And I want to extend that to concepts like mental health because, we're not on the same footing. We're not on an even footing across the world. These guys do think about things very holistically. And fascinatingly, you mentioned two of my favorite guys at the moment, Finn Allen and Devon Conway. They both play for the same domestic side. And from what I know about that side, it's a unit. And this is what happens, right? You create units and that energy comes through. So you also mentioned Tom Latham stepping into Kane Williamson's shoes. Made it look effortless, made it look like he does it all the time, and actually took on Kane Williamson's role with the batting as well, which was bat slowly, see out some very difficult batting, bowling, excuse me, and when you've got a measure of what's happening, accelerate and chase. And he did it so very well to the extent that I sat there watching him and I was like, this is kind of boring because he was following a game plan and he did it very successfully. And I mean that in a complimentary way, that this is kind of boring because you see exactly how he's very slowly rotating, racking up the score, pushing down that run rate. And it's such boring, simple stuff. But I think these guys are hitting all of the basics, whether it's psychological, mental health and well-being, team culture. And that is something that I've noticed watching the international side up close for the last two seasons, is you can very much see players that started out, learnt their cricket, and maybe flourished and started to blossom under the tenure of Brendan McCullum. And now they're playing under a leader who they very much respect, but is their peer and is a very different style. And there is actually a wonderful stylistic blend of that McCullum aggression era and Kane Williamson, who, if I wanted to compare him to any other captain I've seen, it's Misbah Ul-Haq, hands down. I think Misbah is probably the best comparator for Kane Williamson's style. Sometimes doesn't look super interesting or exciting, but I mean, who walks away with the wins? So what they've managed to do as a side is very much blend those styles, support players in their own style. You've got guys like Kyle Jameson, whose natural energy is so different from Kane Williamson's, but there's no forced culture where do as I do as I say, or whatever. It's who you are and how you fit into the side. So I think it's honestly such a boring reason that New Zealand are so good, but it's the truth. It's the simple stuff. It's the building blocks that they're doing very successfully. And I really think there's no time that I don't watch them. Even if, let's say, Colin de Grandhomme's injured and they're subbing in Daryl Mitchell and nobody else knows who Daryl Mitchell is, there's no time that you watch this side and they're not a complete unit. There were moments this summer where Pakistan had sessions where they put some pressure on New Zealand and you saw momentary slips, but they were only momentary. They did not last that long. And that's exactly why they are such a complete team. You ask about the secret of their success, and I think their completion, as Kyle Jameson has made a massive difference, I think, to this bowling side because he's added that extra aggression that previously only existed in the test side through Neil Wagner, but I think less so in the white ball stuff. So Kyle Jameson's really rounded out the situation. I think every team should be concerned about facing New Zealand or looking forward to the challenge, let's say, facing New Zealand. I think if I were New Zealand, if I were the Black Caps and I were thinking about my own weaknesses as a squad, then really spin is the last thing. The last thing. Having dangerous spin, having effective spin, not a defensive holding spin bowler, but an attacking spinner, I think that is the one place that they're not covered. Otherwise, they've got crazy big hitter. That clean hitting, Finn Allen is, I think, 21 years old, maybe 22 at this stage. He's a baby. He's an under-19s product who, you know, his first year on the domestic scene, you know, nothing special, nothing crazy to write home about. And then this year he moved to Wellington, and really from the get-go, I think it became very clear that this guy's going to see his international debut very soon. So, you know, I think it's good to get that out of the way as quickly as possible and maybe not worry about your international debut too much and just keep doing what you're doing. But I think that's a really solid future in a player like Finn Allen. Devin Conway is a whole other story. He is, I think, where South Africa's political problems have hurt South Africa as a country, as a cricketing nation, and made things difficult for them. They've only really enriched the rest of us, whether it's England or New Zealand. I think everybody's a little bit richer because of South Africa's internal problems. And Devin Conway is one of those cases. He's come to New Zealand as a complete, ready, prepared, mature cricketer who is technically proficient, mentally very, very strong, has really good game awareness that you were talking about earlier, whether it's defensive cricket, rotating the strike, or clean, big hitting. He's got everything. And the thing I think that really sets Devin Conway apart, you know, like from the first time I saw him, I'd have conversations with people about, yeah, looks like he's ready for the international sphere. He's going to be a big cricketer. But until you see someone actually play internationally, those are hypotheticals. He's obviously only had a couple of games against West Indies, Pakistan and Bangladesh under favorable home conditions. But I think what we've seen indicates that he might have a late start to his international career. But that is not something that will deter him or the Black Caps from fielding a talent like him. And I think all of these little things, these debuting guys at 21 without any pressure, without the expectation that, hey, how come you didn't make 75 like you do domestically, or picking up 30-year-olds and being happy to debut them in their first international match, and then just having those very solid and complete structures. This is what's different about New Zealand than pretty much everywhere else. Like England, they have remarkable bench strength. I think it's very possible. I don't know if this is English bias, but it's very possible that England has a lot more of it, in all honesty, particularly in the white ball sphere. But this is a country that is what? A tiny proportion of the size of England. So the amount of talent that they have is just not going to be comparable. And then the setup of county cricket still is the envy of all other cricketing nations. The resources that New Zealand has, they are maximizing them to the extent that people with greater resources are not. And I do think that that's the boring but very complete secret to these guys' success.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, for me, traditionally, New Zealand and New Zealand cricket have always punched above their weight. So they've always been more than the sum of their parts rather than the other way around, which is kind of what happens to a lot of other teams. So yeah, I've always, and I think universally they've always been kind of viewed in those terms, and certainly this current team kind of lives up to that kind of billing. But if anything, I think this current team has also kind of got a sprinkling of stardust in there as well. Whereas before, maybe, you know, like you say, there's these players like Colin de Grandhomme that you kind of look at and you think, well, you know, he shouldn't really be anything that spectacular, but a whole team of those kinds of players is fantastically effective. And you know, when you've got people like Kane Williamson, and indeed people with the experience of Ross Taylor, who also only played a little part in this current series, or the series against Bangladesh, it really does say something for the strength in depth that you mentioned. So yeah, all is looking rosy for New Zealand cricket. And yeah, as you say, I think it will be a fascinating English summer when they come over, and can't wait to see how they get on in their games over here. But moving on then, let's switch to another sort of topic that you did mention there briefly. And that was Tamim Iqbal. Again, this seems to be, I was talking to Roshan about this in our last in my last podcast, about how there's probably three or four enduring kind of or ongoing narratives around Bangladesh cricket. One of them's basically who should be captain, one of them just involves Shakib, in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, whatever it is. Yeah,
it's amazing that we've only just mentioned him about half an hour in, which is quite staggering in itself. But the other kind of ongoing narrative seems to be around Tamim, and in particular, Tamim and his suitability or his adaptability to the white ball. So when I guess Tamim sort of burst onto the scene all those years ago, 2007 World Cup, dashing kind of opening left-hander, depositing Zahir Khan over his head for six a couple of times when they beat India in that huge upset. But since then, well, not since then, I reckon probably in the last sort of 5 years, certainly, his role in the team has really changed significantly. So he's taken on this role of basically being the anchor at the top of the innings, playing steady, trying to bat deep, bat, you know, as many overs he can, ideally sort of 40 overs plus to kind of allow everyone else in that top order to kind of bat around him. So I think from my point of view, or from, you know, the critic's point of view, it hasn't always gone to plan. Certainly, what has happened a few times is that, you know, he's batted for maybe sort of 20, 30 overs, got his half century, a not very good strike rate, or you know, a strike rate around, let's say, 70. Which I feel in sort of modern ODI cricket really isn't kind of good enough, particularly when you're trying to set the tone at the top of the order. So I feel that happened a little bit in that second ODI. But then I guess one of the things that, or the fallout from the ODI series, was that Tamim hasn't or didn't take part in the T20 series, although that was actually pre-agreed. So that was agreed with the board beforehand for unspecified reasons, just to add a bit of mystery into the whole thing. But it seems from what he said subsequently, he hasn't explicitly said that he's retired from T20 international cricket. And who knows, you know, we all know with sort of South Asian cricket, no retirement is final. So I can well see him appearing maybe in the T20 World Cup. But it seems that for the time being, that's not going to happen, and that he's going to concentrate on tests and ODI cricket as well. So I feel, actually, it's not a huge surprise if you look at the way his career trajectory is kind of gone in the last 5 years. He's obviously trying to elongate his career for as long as possible, and yeah, T20 cricket doesn't seem to be the way for him to do that. Just interested in kind of your views on the whole Tamim debate.
I think it's a fact. He's honestly, I am a sucker for left-handed top order batsman. I think he's a fantastic player. I agree with you about that strike rate, but I do think that strike rate in ODI cricket is a virtue of forcing players into a role. I think he's had a lot of pressure over the last few years to be the glue for a batting order that isn't doing its job, which then means that he can't do his job because he's forced to do a job that he's, I don't know whether he's ill-suited for it, but A, it's excessive pressure, and B, one man cannot bat for 11. We know this. This is true in every cricketing team around the world. So I do think that his career, particularly like you mentioned over the last few years in ODI cricket, has suffered because of what Bangladesh require from him. But I mean, you cannot ask an individual to do the work of an entire batting lineup. And I think him dropping away from T20 cricket wouldn't be the worst thing. I've never perceived him as a you know, it's not like I sit there thinking, oh, he can't play T20 cricket, but I've never perceived him as a T20 cricketer. I've never perceived him as somebody who particularly enjoys T20 cricket as opposed to the other two formats of the game. So it makes perfect sense. And I guess at a certain age, and he is now that certain age, that you hit 30 and you have to make some decisions, and that's where he's at. You know, we mentioned Shakib very briefly, but he's again at a similar age stage of his career where he's got to make some tough decisions as well. He obviously doesn't have the same issue as Thamin because he's been able to fit into so many different molds, so many different roles. His power as an all-rounder is absolute world-class. It's really up there with Ben Stokes. So that's not something that he's been, I think, pressurized to deal with in the same way that Thamin has. But I, at this stage, I think he had very little other avenue for recourse other than saying, let me focus on being the best cricketer that I can be and stay within the formats that may allow my career to head in the direction that I want it to for the last few years of my career. I think he's a very solid test batsman and the side would be a lot poorer without him. So I would much rather that a player as strong, unique, and as important for the next generation of players sticks around, but only in one format or two formats, rather than lose his career early for absolutely no reason. We're not short of T20 players at all. Bangladesh has the BPL, and while it would be nice to see the BPL come back at some point, at some stage, you've got avenues for development. You've got international leagues all over the world. You can't develop test cricketers using league cricket. That's the reality of it. So when you have a gem like that, I think you prolong their test career and not worry about anything else.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. And I think actually the roles that, Thamin plays in the team, well, so he's the ODI captain. He's taken on that captaincy fairly recently during the West Indies series. In fact, he became the full-time captain. So that in itself is quite a big deal. And I think, well, traditionally Bangladesh's weakest format has been T20 cricket. And, you know, that's clearly demonstrated. Yeah. In the series just gone, you know, they lack power hitters, they lack a bit of mystery in their spin, and, you know, a real out and out express bowler. And I think those three ingredients kind of really what you need to be successful in T20 cricket, or at least have a couple of those ingredients maybe. So I think T20 cricket in general in Bangladesh isn't viewed as firstly, they're not very good at it. And so secondly, I guess maybe that follows on the fact that, you know, someone like Thamin feels that, let's concentrate on the other two formats. ODI cricket is, you know, Bangladesh's strength if you look historically at where they've achieved most of their wins and their successes. So yeah, like you say, I think it's quite it's a sensible and quite a mature decision, actually. I think a lot of the time you sort of see players these days, especially, who want to be multi-format players, who want to play in every single format of the game. So it's actually quite refreshing, maybe, that sort of Thamin recognises.
It's okay to be specialised.
Yeah, exactly. He recognises that, you know, he doesn't want to spread himself too thinly. So I think, yeah, a sensible decision. And let's hope that it's one that pays off in the future. So the other thing that I wanted to touch on as well, and we did talk about this, and that was the game in Napier, which will be remembered, well, certainly I'll remember it, for the only game of cricket I've watched where a team batting second doesn't actually know the target that they're chasing. So for anyone who missed this, it was quite a unique set of circumstances. It was, a rain-affected game. New Zealand batted first. I think it was restricted to something like 18 overs in the end they batted, or just over 17 overs. Bangladesh batting second, a DLS adjusted score. But when they came out to bat, they just weren't, well, the score hadn't been confirmed, basically. A big kind of mix-up, I guess, between the match referee, whoever was in charge of the DLS calculations. Also, there seemed to be a big mix-up between the broadcasters, the host broadcasters, the people who were operating the scoreboard in the ground itself there at Napier, and indeed, the Black Caps Twitter handle tweeted the incorrect target as well at the start. So seemed to be a massive mix-up, and then there was actually almost a 10-minute delay after about three or four overs where the umpires realised that, you know, something wasn't quite right. for things to be resolved. And even then, the correct score wasn't arrived at because it was the PAR, the DLR PAR score that everyone had up on screen rather than the plus one run that was needed. So yeah, all a massive kind of mix up. I guess, just interested to know why. Well, I guess lots of people want to know why this happened. I don't know if you've got any kind of particular views or angles on it. I just think, yeah, if it was a high profile game, if India were involved, if England were involved, this would be like headline news. I'm sure the ICC would get involved. I'm sure maybe even some heads might roll. Not that I want that to happen. I'm sure it's a lovely place. But is there any particular in Napier? Are they even more laid back than?
You know what? We've got new broadcasters here and they're broadcasting cricket for the first time. And while I'm not saying that means that they're green, it's not Sky Sports after very many years. So I'm sure there are some slight teething problems involved. The matches were actually on quite late, in all honesty, for New Zealand time. They were not a massively favorable time. I think I was getting home at like 1 a.m. and stuff. So they were really, really late. I think it's just a matter of a little bit of tiredness, slightly green broadcasters, you know, few kinks that will be ironed out, I'm sure, by the time next season rolls around. Someone was very tired that day. It wasn't just me.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it was quite a, unique kind of set of circumstances, I'm sure. Yeah, lessons will be learned is the main thing, because I guess I don't know if New Zealand are planning to host any kind of international tournaments, World Cups or anything in the future. But yeah, certainly you don't want that kind of thing happening.
Women's World Cup, Women's T20 World Cup is next year. And you're right, absolutely, that cannot be something that happens then. But I think it's a kink, and a kink that we probably won't see again.
Absolutely, yeah. So, yeah, Tasneem, it's been fantastic kind of talking today. I feel we've covered a whole range of topics, even though on the face of it, it was just quite a simple kind of series to dissect. So really happy to have you on. So let's wrap it up there. Thanks again, Tasneem, for joining us. Thank you for tuning in. And please do join us for the next edition of the Sightscreen Cricket Journal podcast. Thank you. Goodbye.